I want to speak today about another hint to Elul that's not well known, more obscure hint, not like the more well known ones, Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. Last week we spoke about the hint in Arei Miklat, in the cities of refuge. This week's Sedra, there's another hint to Elul based on a Zohar Chodesh. But first let me give you a little background information, and then we'll see where the hint is. The Torah says that if you go out into battle, into a war that is not one of the wars to conquer Eretz Yisrael, but a war outside the borders of Eretz Yisrael, where you're allowed to take captives, and Jewish soldier, sees a non-Jewish woman that he has a desire for, and basically the Torah says that the rabbis say that Lo Dibra Torah Ela Keneged Yetzer Hara, that the Torah understood the psychology of a human being. In a time like that, it's very hard to control your drives and desires, and had the Torah prohibited it completely, the person probably would not have been able to withstand his desire. So the Torah gave a process how to convert this woman in a quick way. It's a process, takes time, and to give him the ability to eventually marry her or to change his mind. And since he has a hope of marrying her, he'll be able to control himself better. And the Torah is hoping that he'll control himself, and after he goes through the process, he's not going to want to marry her and he'll let her go her merry way, assuring that she keeps the seven mitzvahs of Noah and nothing more. Okay. So the Torah says that part of the process is that he brings her home with him as a captive, and she removes the beautiful clothing that the idol worshippers used to dress their daughters and wives up with during battle to entice the enemy soldiers. And she puts on a plain, ordinary dress, and she shaves her head, cuts her nails, and sits in the house for 30 days and cries for her mother and her father. And if after that period he still wants to marry her, and she wants to convert, then he converts her and he marries her. If not, if after this time he decides he doesn't want her, or she refuses to give up her idol worship or to convert, then he sends her free, and that's it, finished. So the Zohar Chadash says that the fact that this woman sits and cries, Yerach Yomim, a month's time, 30 days, is a hint to the month of Elul. Somehow the crying of this captive woman and what we're supposed to be doing during Elul has some kind of parallel. So that's what I want to discuss, what that is. How does the crying of this captive woman for a month give us a hint to what we're supposed to be doing or what the function of Elul is? So let's first understand the function by the case in the Torah itself, and then we'll see how it relates to Elul. First of all, the Ramban. The Ramban says the purpose of this crying is the following. This woman is going to be somewhat coerced, not mamish against her will, but we are trying to impress upon her that in the situation she's in, better for her to convert and marry this guy or whatever, and to accept Yiddishkeit. And before she can start a new life with allegiance to the Torah as a Bas Yisrael, as a convert, she has to totally make closure on her old life. She has to close the door on her past. And crying helps a person to separate himself from the past. You cry over the past, and the crying helps a person to come to closure. That's what the Ramban says, and not all those words. And therefore she cries for her mother and her father. And the Gemara says that it could mean her mother and father literally, or it can mean her old religion, her idolatry. Is also referred to as her mother and father, which means that she has to separate herself from the past and come to the conclusion, come to the acceptance that she's no longer going to have a connection with her mother and father. They're a thing of the past, and she has to start a new life, and also that she has to give up her idolatry. So she's basically crying to close her past life in order that she can make a new start. You can't make a new start until you close the past. And the Tzror HaMor puts it even more clearly, that before this man can marry her and bring her into the covenant of the Torah and Tvila, she has to give up her idolatry, give up her past life. And this is the way to enable her, giving her the chance to cry over the past for 30 days, gives her a chance to come to closure. Now, and how much she is going to be able to be successful in closing off her past is how much she's going to be successful in starting anew. Okay? And the past is not something merely to break away from, but it's to take from the past, we'll see, the positive things, and to leave the negative things and to come to closure with that. So as successful as she will be in dealing with the past, that's how successful she will be in creating a new beginning. Using the past as a foundation, and those things that in the past can't be a foundation will be forgotten and closed off for good. And therefore, I was thinking, interesting idea, it says that a willful conversion, when a person converts willfully, okay, then the person who converts is like a new person. But the Maharal says that a forced conversion doesn't have that effect. The Maharal said it by the following. When the Jewish people accepted the Torah, okay, so they were converted. They should have been like newly born people, and all their biological relationships shouldn't have no halachic connection anymore. In other words, when a convert converts, they are newly born, and even if their entire family converts with them, but each conversion is separate, they're not related anymore. So theoretically, a son could marry his mother, a father could marry his daughter, brothers and sisters could get married, because they're not related. But rabbinically, it's prohibited, because people would say, well, when they were goyim, they couldn't marry. Now they can. So they went to a lesser holiness. So it's not allowed. But theoretically, it's okay. So the Maharal asks, if that's the case, when the Jewish people accepted the Torah, and all of them basically were converts, why were they prohibited to their relatives, right? Now that the Torah was given, they cried over the fact that they had to separate from their spouses who were Torah prohibited relatives to marry, which they married before the Torah was given, because in Egypt it was common to marry incestuous relatives. Why were they prohibited? They all were newly converted people. So the Maharal says this rule only applies to a voluntary conversion. But by the Matan Torah, they were forced into conversion. God picked up the mountain. A forced conversion does not affect a newborn person. That's what he says. Doesn't have that effect. Basically, on the one of the understandings is that if the conversion is totally voluntary, a person is making a totally new beginning. But if it has to be forced, then they're not separating themselves from the past completely. Then there's a certain amount that the past is still there, because they had to be forced to make this beginning. And therefore, they can't be considered like a newborn person. If that would be the case, then the same thing over here. If we're going to have to force this woman to convert, she hasn't made closure on the past, but it's something external that's forced to a certain degree, then she's not really making a new beginning. She's not like a new person. But if it's going to be totally voluntary, if after the 30 days period, the process, she comes to the realization that she makes closure on the past, and she starts anew, then it's like a completely new beginning. So how much is forced and how much is voluntary is going to make how much of a new beginning it is and how much not, and how strong the beginning is and how not. thinking that there's another parsha in this week's Sedra that has a similar, we can make a similar parallel. Okay, before we go on and explain more how this process works by this woman. The process of Ben Soru Mora, a child who's just bar mitzvah, first 6 months after his bar mitzvah, and he exhibits the following behavior. He refuses to be disciplined, doesn't listen to his parents at all. He steals from them, buys wine and guzzles it, buys food and eats it like a glutton. Okay, we warn him. The parents bring him to court and they beat him once. If he does it a second time, within that 6 month period, he is executed. Because the Torah says that a person like that, who at the very beginning of his adult life shows absolutely no discipline, he's totally a hedon, he's interested in drinking, he steals, right? What's going to happen is that he's not going to be able to constantly steal from his parents, so he's going to have to steal from other people in order to keep up his lifestyle, because that's all he's interested in, and he has no discipline. So eventually he's going to end up murdering people, and then we're going to catch him and execute him when he has no share in the world to come because he's lost it. So better execute him now while he still has a share in the world to come than let him continue a life like that. Now, the problem with this is that usually we don't judge people on what they're going to do in the future. God judges people as they are now. So why do we look to the future? But over here, the idea is this child is starting off his adult life. So he is either making a new fresh start, and it's really bad. His fresh start in life is like already starting downhill. So it's just going to be a slippery slope. So therefore, we're judging him on the future because this is his behavior now, his behavior for the future. Or it's possible that this child is not starting off, right, on a really bad note, his adult life, but he's just continuing and finishing off his bad education from his childhood. Therefore, the Torah says that if we can point the finger to the parents not giving him a good education, the Gemara says if the parents don't speak with one voice, literally, but it could also mean that the child didn't get a message of education from the father and mother equally. They didn't speak with one voice. They can't identify the child. They are missing an arm. They can't point to the child and say, this is our child. Because they don't know who the child is. In a more drash, they're blind, meaning they have no idea what's going on with their child. They're mute, means they never bothered to really educate the child properly. They're deaf. They don't know. They can't listen to the child. So all the seeds of education are not there. Then you can't blame this child. He's not making a bad start. He's just continuing a bad education. He hasn't made closure on his youth, on his when he was a minor. It's not that he's starting as an adult in a terrible way. He's just continuing being a minor in a terrible way. And then you blame the parents and you don't kill him. But if basically his education was fine and he is closing off the past and starting on his adult life in the most horrendous way, then we can blame him, and then we judge him for the future because that's what he's starting now, the future. Okay, in any case, so there's a connection a little bit with that. Now let's go back to this woman, okay? We don't want her to make closure on the past completely. Even a person who's making a new start in life doesn't erase the past because there are very positive things in the past too that you have to take into the future and use them as a foundation for the future. Therefore, we give her the chance to cry Yerach Yomin. Yerach is an interesting word. It's a word that means Chodesh. But Chodesh means new. Yerach is the month going away. Right? The 30-day period can be a new month, or it can be the end of the month. We're looking here at the more at the end of the period. Purpose is not the beginning of the 30 days. The purpose is what's going to be at the end of the 30 days. And the Torah uses the word Yerach in regards to Geresh Yerachim. The moon has an effect on crops, on fruit, in ripening it on the tree, just like the sun has an effect. The moon's effect is more or less to ripen the fruit and make it ready to be separated from the tree. That's called Geresh Yerachim. It like pushes it off, right? Pushes it away from the tree. So here, the Yerach, the word Yerach, has the connotation of a 30-day period where you want to end the period and push away what was from the past and start anew. And therefore, we want to know what she's pushing away. Either, she will push away her past in a positive way, so she'll be able to make a new beginning, or if she can't do that, then the man should push her away. So somehow this 30-day period is going to end off with something being ripened, pushed away. Either she'll be ripe to convert and start a new life, or she'll be pushed away because then it's better not to marry her. Okay? And or there's a third possibility, that he'll push away her past forcibly and coerce her into converting, but then it won't be a good thing. So if there's three possibilities here. The person will see that he can't cause her to give up her past, then leave her. He'll see she'll be able to give up her past the proper way, which we'll get to in a second. And therefore he'll marry her. Or he'll coerce her into giving up her past and also marry her. Now, two of these things are positive. One's very negative. If he has to coerce her into giving up the past, she's not willing to do it the proper way herself, and he marries her, then the Gemara says this marriage is going to end in disaster. He's going to end up hating her, and they're going to end up having a Bensoro Mora. Their children aren't going to be good. Because basically this woman has not made closure on her past. She's not a new person. She's been coerced into accepting Torah, and that's not healthy. But he's marrying her basically because he can't give up his desire for her, because obviously this is not a great shidduch. So that's not a good situation. Not from the father's side, not from the mother's, not from the husband, not from the wife. The second possibility is that he'll see that he can't, she can't make closure on her past, and he'll let her go. Not going to marry her. He will give up his desire, let her go. She's not for me. That will be positive. Okay? Or the best situation would be that she comes to realize that, yes, this is the life that she wants. She makes closure on the negative things of the past. She accepts the Torah willingly, makes a new start in her life, and he marries her. Then a Yifas Tohar can be like any Gioris, a Tzadekis, Rus. And from that can come Shlomo HaMelech and the Beis HaMikdash and Geula and tremendous things. So we want something here to be divorced, to be pushed away. Either her old life or her, but if both of those things, either of those don't happen, right, then it's not a good situation. If he can't push her away and she can't push away her past, then it's going to be disastrous. Okay, so that's why it says Yerach. Now, I was thinking, David HaMelech married a Yifas Tohar. It says David HaMelech actually married one of these captured women. Now the Gemara says that it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing's going to come, like we said. But that's only, like we said, under the eventuality that she can't close the past and he still marries her. So David HaMelech thought that the woman he married, who was a Yifas Tohar, did close off her past. And therefore marrying her is a great thing. And she could start a new thing. She could be like Rus and Nama, and good things could come from it. In the end, David HaMelech saw he made a mistake. His intentions were pure, but the woman's intentions weren't. She didn't separate herself from the past completely. And because of that, Avshalom, who rebelled against his father, was born from that union. And that's what happened. That's why Avshalom rebelled against his father, because he was the product of an Eishes Yifas Tohar. That's what the Gemara says.
I thought that there was never a Bensor or Mora.
No Bensor or Mora. We're talking about Eishes Yifas Tohar now.
No, but didn't we say that in the third situation, if he marries somebody...
Right. Eventually, there never was a Bensor or Mora who could be executed because it didn't fit all of the conditions. But there could be somebody who was a Bensor or Mora, just wouldn't be executed because the conditions didn't exist. I was thinking that with that you can understand the following. It says in Tehillim, Mizmor le David bevarcho mipnei Avshalom beno. right? A song of David when he was running away from his son Absalom, who was rebelling against him, wanted to kill him. So what was David singing about? Should have said a lament. Kina le David. Why Mizmor le David? So Gemara says, because it's not normal for a son to rebel against his father. Okay? And therefore, what's it called? David HaMelech saw that this was something out of the ordinary, that obviously was the hand of the Rebbe Nishol. I was thinking, what it means is the following. A son doesn't rebel against his father. So if Avshalom rebelled, that means that he went more after the mother that wasn't proper, the Eishes Yifas Toar, and that's why he rebelled. It wasn't David's fault, because a son doesn't rebel against his father. So if, in fact, right, it was David HaMelech who had the wrong intention, and he was the cause, then this was a son rebelling against the father. But if David HaMelech's intentions were pure, and it was the problem that the wife, who he thought also had pure intentions, wasn't so pure, then it was because he rebelled against because of the mother, not because of the father, because the father, you don't rebel against your father. So he rebelled because of the tainted mother, then that made David HaMelech feel a little bit better, that he wasn't the cause, that it must have been the fact that he misunderstood his wife's intentions. Okay. In any case, let's go on to the more significant thing here. The Ibn Ezra says, why does she cry? Okay, so we said one idea is to make closure with the past. But we say closure with the past does not mean totally erasing the past, because there are positive things in everybody's past. Even an idol worshipper's past, there are positive things. Therefore, the Ibn Ezra says the crying is also for the parents as a sign of kavod. Kibud av v'aim. This woman has a debt of gratitude to her parents. They brought her into the world. So it's right to cry for them. She's not going to see them again. They may have been killed in the battle. Cry for your parents. It's right. Hakaras hatov. Be grateful to the fact that your parents brought you in this world. So cry over the things of the past that are proper to cry about in a positive way. And recognize the fact that there were positive things in your past, and hakaras hatov to a parent is one of them. Also, cry over the fact that your parents, if you now realize that a Jewish way of life is far superior to your idolatrous way of life, you see now what a Jewish family life is or whatever, and you compare it to what your parents' life was under idolatry, then also cry for them that they didn't have the opportunity to see that themselves. They didn't become Jewish. They didn't have the opportunity to see what a Jewish life is and convert. So you're crying for the parents as a sign of hakaras hatov, of gratitude to them. At the same time, you feel bad for them that they didn't have a chance to be exposed to Yiddishkeit. And therefore, the crying also is to make closure and separate herself from the idolatry and from the negative things of the parents. So there's a mixture over here. There's the positive things. There's the feeling that the past could have been better, and I feel bad that the past didn't have a chance to do what I can do in the future, and the negative things that where you want to separate yourself from them. Three different purposes in the crying. Separate yourself from the past, the negative. Bemoan the fact that you could have made the past better and didn't. And take the good things from the past and recognize them and use them as building blocks for the future. Now, there's another aspect of the crying. The crying is not only for the sake of this woman. It's for the sake of the man, too. He's also involved in this. He has to make a decision. She has to make a decision whether she wants to become Jewish. He has to make a decision whether it's proper to marry her if her decision is strong enough or not. So he has to watch her crying. And he has to distinguish in her crying what kind of crying this is. Is she crying over the past because she wants to go back? Or is she crying over the past because she wants to make closure? Is she taking the positive things from the past or negative things from the past? So you have to watch her for 30 days, cry in the house, and come to a decision based on her type of crying, right, whether he wants to continue this or not. Is he blinded by his desire, his lust, or is he going to be able now to see things in an objective way, and if he ends up marrying her for the right reasons, not because he lusted after her. Therefore, we make her take off her fancy clothing, so he can see what she is really, the inside, not be allured by the externals. First thing. Second thing, shave her head, which means get back to your what's it called? Take away any preconceived notions, and hashkafa wise, right? Let her get that back to the roots of her thinking, and reassess them. And he has to look at her also from without preconceived notions, right? From the roots, not from the external. And cut her nails. Why? The nails represent the extension of a person's actions. Go back and start again. Start the extension of your actions anew, and he has to be able to look at her and see what is she, what kind of person is she, what are her hashkafas, what are her actions, right? Let her start again. Is she separating herself from the past and making a new start? Fine. She's not making a new start, then that's not for me. You have to be able to see her objectively, not with all the externals that attracted you before. Look at it now and make the decision based on intellect, not on emotion. Now, if that is the whole idea of the crying of this woman, it fits Elul perfectly. Why? Because the month of Elul, right, the Rabbeinu Bachya says, when it says, Lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzer hara, aside from the idea that I told you before, that it means that the Torah was speaking against the desire of the person that the Torah knew he couldn't control, and therefore it permitted this, even though it could be it's not a good thing. But if he did, the Torah didn't permit it, the person would do it anyway, and then do it in a very horrendous way. So better to give him this process where it could work out okay. The Rabbeinu Bachya says another meaning. The Torah gave us this whole case to be a parallel to how to deal with the Yetzer Hara. Meaning like this. Elul is the last month of the year. Rosh Hashanah were supposed to come and make a new beginning. New year, new beginning. The Rabbeinu Yonah says a person on Rosh Hashanah should feel like he's a newborn person. And the past is in the past, and now he's starting a new slate. That's how it gives you the ability to start again every year. Okay? But how you start anew depends on how you close the old. What kind of closure you make on the negatives. What you recognize as positive that you can use as building blocks for the future. Because even a newborn person had a pregnancy before. He was in the womb. So there are things before birth that you take, what's it called, and use as building blocks for the beginning, for the new. So you have to take the positive from the old and use it for building blocks of the new, close off the negative, and bemoan the fact that you didn't make the best of the past. Hopefully you'll make the best of the future. Those are the crying that we said. And to analyze things, to see the past in its seemingly naked objectivity. Take away all the allure, all the nice fancy clothing that you dressed it up and masked it with, all the things of the past, and see them objectively. Go back to your, reassess your preconceived notions, shave your head, right? Cut your nails, right? Get back to the basics and reassess everything that happened in the past in an objective way. See which things are supposed to remain in the past, you make closure on, which things can be building blocks for the future, and which things, had you had the chance, you would have done better, will do better in the future because you could have made them better in the past. That's exactly parallel to this crying of the woman, both from her side and from your side. And then when you've come to the conclusion of which things to divorce yourself from, which things to, what's it called, to embrace, then it's possible that you'll make a new start and you'll end up marrying this woman, meaning then you'll have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with a new start, which after going through this whole process of Elul, and Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, you'll come to the time where you mamish, then become one with the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is possible with this woman too, if everything goes proper, and that's called Shmini Atzeres. That's Simchas Torah. That's when you become one with the Ribbono Shel Olam after this whole process. After you throw away the what has to be thrown away, and you embrace what has to be embraced, and you improve what has to be improved, and you make a new start based on all of that, then you have a chance to what's it called, to make the best of what the past was and convert it literally into something very, very positive. So that's the connection, very strong connection between what Elul is and the crying of this captive woman. Okay. Any questions on okay. I've another minute or two, somebody mentioned something else from the Sedra. It says that like we said, that the battle, when you go out to battle your enemy, the major battle the person has to battle in this world is connected to Yetzer Hara. He's the biggest enemy, and that's the battle that a person fights his whole life. The Mesillas Yesharim says that a wise man once greeted a group of soldiers coming back from war, and he said, now you're going into the greatest battle, because now you have to face the battles, your own personal battles, not the physical ones. So the Arizal Taka says that Kiseitze L'Milchom Alevecha is a hint to the battle with the Yetzer Hara. There's only one problem. Like I started off with today, this battle is not a battle that you have to fight on Milchemes Mitzvah, on Milchemes Chova. That battle is conquering Eretz Yisrael. It's a mitzvah. You have to make that battle. Right? It can't be talking about a Milchemes Mitzvah, a battle that you have to do, and it's a mitzvah to do, because you're not allowed to take captives in such a battle. In such a battle, you wipe out the seven nations, man, woman, and children. So it must be talking about a battle that is voluntary. In other words, not a mitzvah, not a chova, not conquering Eretz Israel, a battle that you fight because of whatever reason, outside the boundaries of Eretz Israel, to extend the boundaries of Eretz Israel, for economic reasons, for whatever, right? For possible security reasons in the future. There, you're not supposed to kill everybody, right? You kill the people who come against you to kill you, and the women, children, whatever, you can take captive, leave them, let them, what's it called, exist, and you take a tax from them, and that's what the war was all about. So if that's the case, how in the world could the Torah hint to the battle with the Yetzer Hara in a battle that is voluntary and not mandatory? Isn't the battle with the Yetzer Hara a mandatory one, a mitzvah? And yet we're representing it in a battle that's voluntary. It's not a mitzvah. How could that be? I was thinking the following. There's a Kli Yoker. The Kli Yoker says that the Gemara says that the Yetzer Hara is compared to a fly. He says one of the analogies is the following. If you have an apple, and nobody has touched the apple, a fly can't bother it. But if somebody took a bite out of the apple, then the fly can devour it. The Yetzer Hara needs a Pesach. He needs an opening. If you don't give him an opening, right, he can't get started. But if you give him an opening, you let your guard down, then the Yetzer Hara will take advantage of the opening, and then you're finished. Therefore, the fight with the Yetzer Hara can't be when there's already an opening, when there's already a question of right and wrong, because then you've already let your guard down, you're already fighting in no man's land. You're already fighting on your property. That's no good. Once the enemy comes into your domain, right, two strikes against you already. You have to fight off the enemy on his ground or in no man's land before he gets to you. You have to make sure that he doesn't have an opening. And then you have the ability to vanquish the Yetzer Hara. Therefore, the war with the Yetzer Hara is not when it's a mitzvah, not when you're dealing with right and wrong. It's when you're dealing with things that are permissible, but you make offense and fight off the Yetzer Hara before it becomes to right and wrong, while it's still just the areas that are areas of permissibility where you're going to make a fence around yourself, and you're not fighting over things that are prohibited and things that are permitted. Everything's permitted, but you're going to make offense and prohibit to yourself certain permitted things so it never comes to the actual prohibited things. Right? For instance, say a person has a desire, what's it called, he knows that he can't hold up if he gets this real big desire to eat treif. Right? Just loves to eat. And this is his favorite food. So he makes offense Not that he has that food and he's ready to walk into the restaurant and he has a Yetzer Hara now. Should I go into the restaurant or not? He makes a fence not to walk on that block, to walk past the restaurant and get a whiff of the aroma of his favorite food. So he started fighting the Yetzer Hara not when he's on the doorstep of the restaurant and the question is, do something wrong or right? You've already let your guard down. You're by the restaurant. That's already the apple's been bitten into. You're probably going to lose. But if you make a permissible, you could walk everywhere you want. Right? There's nothing wrong with walking on the street. And you're going to prohibit yourself walking on that street so you don't come into contact with that aroma and don't have the nisayon. Right? That's where you fight the Yetzer Hara. That's totally voluntary. That's not something that's a mitzvah because there's no prohibited and permitted over there. So the fight with the Yetzer Hara has to be when it's voluntary. Otherwise, you're probably going to lose. That's why the Torah used the parallel of a voluntary war to be the example of the war with the Yetzer Hara. Because that's a start when it's only voluntary. If you start when it's already a question of right and wrong, prohibited and permitted, you've already behind the game. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the story like? I was wondering because someone is in love
Now they love with somebody that's not Jewish and you can't convince them to break up, but the woman or the man will be willing to convert and really live a Jewish life. And they'll be 100% gay.
But is that
not really forced. That's voluntary, except there was an ulterior motive. But now the person really wants to convert. Okay? Because of the ulterior motive. Then they're going to live a 100% Torah life.
Okay.
So that's enough to beat the gayers. If the real motivation is still the marriage, then it's not. Obviously not 100%. Halachically, we don't know, so therefore you have to assume that it was voluntary. Okay? But inside could be the woman still attached, right? But she's still a Jew.